Any more questions? Are we born with a sense of self, or is this delusion seeded and cultivated by the world around us? And if a child was raised being taught non-self and non-identity, I wonder how they would turn out. This is something that's deeply ingrained in the human psyche, and we exacerbate it through delusion and conditioning of the world around us. But that fundamental sense of I, me, mine, it's not so much a fully formed sense of I or me, but it's like the, you can see a little baby not getting its way, and it definitely reacts. So it's not so much of, say, raising a child to be taught non-self and non-identity, but raising a child to be well-established in gratitude and generosity and kindness and unselfishness. That's more the point of the Buddha's teaching. It's not sort of, say, a philosophical point of the doctrine of non-self. It's the ability to not get caught in the things that are self-destructive, self-aggrandizing, all of the unskillful emotions that we identify with. What does it mean when a monk breathes in, he satisfies the mind? As part of the Anapanasati Sutta, when I gave the kind of review of the Anapanasati Sutta, I used the word gladdening. So that consciously directing attention to breathing in, gladdening, satisfying. The word in Pali is apipamoja, which is sort of a delighting, actually, fairly strong. Delighting the mind when breathes in, delighting the mind when breathes out. So actually consciously directing attention to either the feeling or an associative thought that helps the mind to experience that sense of gladdening, satisfying, delighting, because it's actually a lot more fruitful than being the serious meditator. I'm a serious meditator. And I'm skilled at making myself miserable. At times the breath becomes very subtle, almost imperceptible. I try to focus on the still point, but don't seem to be able to absorb. No lights have yet appeared. The space is quite pleasant, but eventually the refinement seems to dissipate and fade. Anything else to quote-unquote do? Well, I think it's just as this is where the being patient, repeating, one's already has the positive feedback that the breath becomes subtle. There is a pleasant feeling of space. One of the things that one can do is just to, sometimes what happens is we try to objectify something like an object of attention, the object of meditation. And sometimes it's helpful to turn the attention inward and pay attention to the subject in the sense of the quality of the awareness that is paying attention, the quality of the awareness that recognizes there's a subtlety, and there's a pleasant, spacious feeling, and starting to attend to that, clarify it slightly, and not getting too, controlling about it, but allowing that internal awareness to come forward. That tendency to objectify can also be just that extra effort that one is putting out to be able to stop, to step back from the doer and be with the knowing. Okay. Any suggestions for calming the breath slash body when its mind is set on racing? Well, one is, you know, one recognizes that you can start, because sometimes it's helpful just bringing up imagery in the sense of the, you sort of see the mind racing, and then to be able to, almost like making a cartoon figure out of the racing meditator. And then say, just be gentle, slow down, calm down, find a nice corner and sit in. Yeah, so it's like treating it as your pet meditator. Because sometimes we get entangled in the mind or try too hard. Because that's oftentimes where that kind of racing agitation, where sometimes we're trying a bit too hard. So that will relax. And coming back to the breath, the body, allowing that to soften, and using the breath as a means of softening, warming, soothing the body, and allowing the mind to settle in it. Each in-breath, each out-breath, giving permission for the mind to do that. Was Ajahn Chah an arahant? How can one tell when someone's work is done? Also, is it inappropriate to ask one's teacher if they are a stream enterer, once returner, etc.? You want to be careful what you ask. Ajahn Chah, one of the things, I remember him saying, you know, people project onto the teachers, call me this, call me that. And to me, I'm more like a tree that the birds can come and can feed in, and I hopefully provide the fruit for people. But what I am is, it's just the chattering of the birds. So he certainly never sort of declared himself an arahant and never made a big statement or anything about different kinds of attainments, arahant, stream enterer, once returner. But what he did always pay attention to and to encourage people to ask is, are you suffering? Because that's the criterion that the Buddha gives for us to investigate. If there's still suffering, there's still work to be done. And that sense of keeping it simple, keeping experiential. And then, you know, how can one tell when someone's work is done? Only by inference, really, or by observation. The Buddha actually sort of says, you really can't tell another person's wisdom or attainment except through long observation, long contact. And even then, it's still not a sure thing. But one gets a sense, seeing somebody in many different types of situations, seeing them and recognizing that they don't fall for the normal patterns of greed, hatred, and delusion. It seems fairly consistent. But in the end, that one can't be 100% sure either, because you can't really know the mind of somebody else. I've seen both sides of the coin. There was one monk who, a couple monks had sort of said, oh, he's so calm, he's so composed, he must have some sort of attainment. A couple months after that, we had to take him to the psych ward. And then another place I went to, I remember that I didn't meet the monk myself, but the abbot of the monastery was telling me, he was the former abbot of the monastery, and he just seemed like a nice old man. Nothing particularly special. People were respectful, but not that impressed with him as a teacher while he was living. He died, and then they did the cremation. After the cremation's over, they go to collect the ashes, and just everything is turned to relics. There's all these wonderful crystals and relics that appeared. Yeah, sometimes you don't know. As I finished one length of my walking path, I realized I was not the same person as when I started. That I was making myself each moment based on choices I make. How do I develop, or at least remember this, so I don't fall back into habitual patterns? it seems like each morning I have to rebuild my awareness. Yes, exactly. It's this, the actual recognition of that, and then that mindfulness is actually the root of the word that's used for mindfulness is from memory. It's like remembering to be present and remembering to not get lost and realizing that, you know, we don't have to carry around the same old person all the time. Before my Dhamma eye opened, all I could see was macro suffering, but now I can see nano suffering on a massive scale. Sometimes I don't want to look. Any words of advice and encouragement? Yes. How can I count the ways that I suffer? Yeah, and I think that's the whole point, really, as we turn our attention to Dhamma, because usually that the macro suffering is sort of seeing it out there and projecting it externally. The world is a place of misery and difficulty, blah, blah. But then as you develop some awareness, attention, discernment, you start recognizing, yeah, we're actually carrying it around with us. It's like Ajahn Chah telling one of his monks that you're suffering here, you're suffering at your kuti, you're suffering in the meditation hall. It's like monks have a monk's bag. And he said, it's like you got dog shit in your bag. And everywhere you go, you sit down and you say, God, it smells awful here. I gotta go somewhere else. And so you pick your bag up and go somewhere else. You're carrying it with you. That's the sort of pervasive kind of suffering that we carry around with us. And of course, that's what the practice is for really being able to understand that process and see that more clearly and recognize, but yeah, we can relinquish that. We can deal with it. How should a stream enterer skillfully deal with delusional others, especially when it comes to family members? I feel like things can get really weird when the view of a stream enterer is so much different from the rest. One of the fundamental benefits of a stream enterer is that they don't suffer as much. So whether it's creating suffering for oneself or creating suffering in relationship to family, then it's just not worth it. You don't need to pick it up. One of the things that I always tell the monks, after some time, their family will want them to go home and make a visit, home, visit with family members. And one of the things I'll always tell them is to don't try to make them understand what you're doing. Don't try to convince them that what you're doing is any good or anything. Because one can be end up in these incredibly complicated and difficult interactions with family members if one is trying to convince them, or one's convinced of one's view, or that one is anything other than patient and kind and considerate. Which sometimes that it's not just others that are deluded. What is the proper hand positions while bowing? I see many various positions in the lay people and some variation in the monastics. I mean, generally, just keeping the hands in front of the chest while one's bowing, lifting it up, coming down in front of one, usually keeping it so the elbows are about at the side of one's knees, and then the hands slightly apart, so that one's forehead comes in between, and then keeping the hand sort of like that. That's a really proper Ajahn Chah Bao. I can remember him sort of, oh, you know, when you're bowing, you know, again, it's sort of that necessity of sustaining mindfulness, because sometimes one can, you know, you bow to get it over with, or one can bow while one's mind's proliferating about something else, or one can have one's hands in Anjali kind of flopping down. There, Ajahn Chah said, well, it's sort of like corpses in Thailand. When somebody dies, they, you know, you put them in the coffin, get them ready for burial, and you try to get their hands in some sort of position. Before the rigor mortis sets in too badly. Please share thoughts on how to bring home and develop ways to be a better spouse and father. What from the practice might help the most towards kindness, generosity, and being present? I think one is just that recognition, or that intention, or that kind of wish to be a better spouse, be a better father, be a better person, to be present. Especially in terms of being a parent and a partner, I think one of the things is, a part of the aspect of patience is not just putting up with people, but to recognize that one, that say the patience that's willing to give time to people, to give time to others, to set aside one's own agenda, movement, mood, and to really give, whether it's partner, children, family members, friends, whatever, to really have that patience to give others time. And you realize that you've got the time when, again, when you're not swept up in one's own proliferations and opinions and views. I heard in your ghost story about dedicating merit. How do I do this? I would like to improve the karma of my mother and little brother. Any suggestions, welcome. And one is, say that, dedicate. Sort of whenever one does anything that, you know, is generous, kind, offerings, whatever, actually bringing that goodness to mind and then formulating the wish that may it benefit. And you know, one can direct that attention to a particular person, that sense of, may this be a benefit to my mother, my little brother. But then also one can expand that, may it be a benefit to all beings. And just really putting that, because that's that intention of sharing goodness, you know, bringing that kind of wholesome intention and goodness into the world is something that is, even if nobody else benefits, then you do. I might miss a word or two in this. Can you speak more about perception? Confusion arises when I see perception and also see that the perception is accurate to what has occurred. That is, the other person was disregarding, attacking, etc. So not only my memory, I also see identifying dukkha. Can you speak to this? Thank you. The function of perception, you know, one of the functions is memory, or perceiving, recognizing. But then it's also part of the function of perception is the giving an importance to a particular way of perceiving, so that, and we frame things before we even think about it oftentimes, so that that function of perception is already framing how we're looking on a particular situation, how we view ourselves. And of course, the way that the mind moves after is a function of that perception. And so that we can see or recognize how perception is functioning as we see the thoughts come out from that. We're seeing like citta sankhara, our feeling and perception, because it builds the thought processes. And there's actually a whole set of practices that the Buddha gives of using perception to, or perceptions in order to reestablish a wholesome relationship. Because even if something is correct or accurate in a sense, but it's still creating suffering, then it's up to us to do something about that in terms of reconfiguring how we perceive, and so that we're not carrying suffering around with us wherever we go, whatever we do. The alternative is trying to restructure the world to shape one's desires and opinions, and that doesn't really work. Hasn't ever yet. So that sense of paying attention to what are the thought processes that come up in the mind, and then you're deducing from that, okay, the perception is one that is coming from negativity, or the perception is one that is coming from fear or desire or kindness or whatever. But it's, there's that recognition, deduction, and then these perceptions that are helpful for the arising of either relinquishment, letting go, or replacing the thoughts with thoughts of kindness or forgiveness. Those are perceptions that one trains oneself in so that one is not creating suffering. Because we tend to get the feeling of being hapless victims of circumstance, and the importance of taking responsibility for where the mind is going, what it's running with, what it's cranking out. And of course, that's a long-term project, and being willing to be patient with that. Did anyone ever need a knee replacement as a result of being on retreat? Okay. Now the real question. Is it okay to set up a few more chairs on the side of the room somewhere? Metta to knees everywhere. There's spaces around, I'm sure we can. Also, all of those, like the benches in the back, are all those are all available. So that just working within the limitations that we have as human beings and having the joints that age. Also, it's good to not have the hope that you're ever going to be able to sit comfortably. I've been waiting for about 40 years to... and to be able to sit free from pain. I get great satisfaction from learning new skills and subjects. However, I get easily immersed, plenty of focus, but no mindfulness. Sometimes I take refuge in this state as it helps me sweep aside what I'd rather not face. Can you offer any advice? Also, are there investigations I might pursue during the retreat that may be helpful? And there's a PS. I hear that accomplished in learning your craftsman skills is a higher blessing. And that's one of the fascinating things with working with the mind, is that there's always something new to learn or some new way of applying. And of course, those learning new skills and subjects, we tend to get really interested in the external ones. But to be able to shift that around to that internal investigation, and then it's always helpful to be able to tune into the body and keeping the body as the anchor so that one can start feeling more clearly, okay, when I get enthusiastic about some new thing, what does it feel like in the body? How to keep kind of an anchor and a relaxed quality in the body, because that's where the focus and attention will be able to sustain itself when it becomes something that's comfortable and it's easeful. So that really bringing that attention back into the body and relaxing, settling, spreading that quality of ease through the body. And then it, and that's probably something to really experiment with in terms of the relationship to sort of new things, and then attuning into, well, what does the body feel like? How to keep that settled, relaxed anchor internally. So that glass of wine at dinner is going to eliminate my chances of stream entry. How about moderation in all things? Somebody's really worried about that glass of wine. That's what will be the obstruction. That's the actual problem. Would you please explain the concept of Bodhisattva, a largely Mahayana teaching in the Theravada tradition? But there's a couple ways to approach this, in the sense that the original use of the word Bodhisattva was referring specifically to the Buddha, in the sense of the being seeking awakening, referring to himself. And then, say, after the death of the Buddha, there's a concept of the accumulation of parami, these wholesome qualities started to be formed and developed as a principle and an ideal. And then the being who was accumulating these wholesome virtues was then also referred to as a bodhisattva. And then in later times, and it's more associated with the Mahayana, but say like in a country like Thailand, long history of being a Theravada country, then there's still a very strong respect, perception of a bodhisattva path and an encouragement for those who are interested to be cultivating that. There's a story of one of the great teachers in Thailand, Somdet Do. He lived about 150 years ago. And he's considered a great meditator and scholar, a very pure-hearted being. And one of the things he would do would to make amulets that had some protective power. And to this day, those are incredibly highly sought after. And if somebody is able to get one of these amulets, then very difficult to get them to relinquish them. And you can trade, I think, a brand new Mercedes SL for one of these amulets, and you might or might not get them. Anyway, he's somebody who was highly regarded. Now, there's a story one time of him hanging his robe up on the line, as you know monks do, to dry, and then it slipped off and fell down, and then this kind of monastery dog came over and curled up on the robe. And then Somdet Do had to go out to do something out of the monastery. And so he went to get his robe, and then this dog was curled up on his robe. It was sleeping. So it stood there waiting for it to wake up. And then one of the monks, because it was probably some invitation or doing something, that one of the monks, they're waiting for Somdet to come, and so they come to check on him, see what happened to him, and he's standing there waiting for this dog to wake up. And they said, "We've all been waiting for you." I said, "Well, there's this dog sleeping on my robe." And he said, why don't you just chase it away? And he said, no, you never know. It could be a bodhisattva. And you just want to be kind to every being. You know, that's that kind of his own, because he was considered a bodhisattva by people. But that's how he viewed the world. Could you please talk about Shakyamuni Buddha, whose teaching we learn, and Buddhas before him, and the one to come, Maitreya? Are the teachings the same? What is important for us to know about the Buddhas? And then there's the 28 Buddhas chant on page 62. Somebody noticed. I can mention it before that the Buddha didn't perceive himself as, say, isolated as the only Buddha, but that this is a principle in nature, that there is the truth that one can be awakened to, and there are these Buddhas who come along. And in the tradition, say, like, the specialness of the Buddha is that they discover this truth and then teach it on their own. So that the way the tradition has been passed down, that, say, these teachings will last for however long. They've been around for 2,500 years, and however long they last. And then at some point in time, the teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha will disappear, and then there won't be this clear access to truth and a path. And then another being will come. And the prediction is the Maitreya Buddha. And each Buddha has a particular characteristic, in the sense that Shakyamuni Buddha, his characteristic or primary mode of being is wisdom. He's a Buddha that exemplifies or embodies wisdom. And of course, the Maitreya Buddha is metta, loving kindness. And the Buddha predicted, I don't know if it's the Buddha or it's a commentarial, but that a Buddha that is embodying loving kindness will draw huge numbers of people to him and be able to enlighten many, many beings. It's the nature of loving kindness. Think of, remember Ajahn Liam. Ajahn Liam was the successor to Ajahn Chah, the abbot of Wat Pho Phong. Some people here may have met him. Very composed, grounded being. And anyway, I remember him talking one time and saying, you know, Ajahn Chah had tremendous loving kindness. And because of that, he had many, many people coming to him all the time. I'm going to focus on equanimity. it's tiring to have loving kindness. So that, say, the Buddhas in the past would have had some particular characteristics. And I think, brother, say, that chant of the 28 Buddhas is, I think, to put more of that context of, we're fortunate enough to come into contact into this long lineage of awakened beings and to make the best use of that. Is it atta that carries karma? Is it atta that takes a rebirth? How can we talk about atta? Oh, you can talk all you want about it. But it'll keep suffering. There's an old conundrum in terms of trying to find something that is an essence, is a central sort of core. And this is exactly why the Buddha is pointing to these are natural processes that don't actually need some sort of central self, soul, to perpetuate itself. Karma looks after itself. It doesn't need atta to do it. And the rebirth takes place whether one has the concept of a soul or a self or not. So that the not-self strategy is kind of the balance between the... Because there's... Atta is the sense of taking that concept of a personality, an identity, and having that kind of as an eternal principle. And most religions tend to use that as the basis for their worldview. In opposition to that is nihilistic or annihilationism. And in terms of the Pali, you've got atta as self, and you have witlatta as kind of a negation of self or a nihilistic annihilation. And then sort of coming into balance or in the middle point is anatta, this non-self strategy, where you're seeing that it's not these things that we normally identify with or normally create identity around. By their very nature, they can't be. They're not self because they're impermanent, they're inconstant, they're changing, so that one is able to relinquish that attachment to that identity with self, and then to not identify with the annihilation of self. It's just seeing nature coming into being and ceasing, and not being dragged into that process through the impulse or compulsion of identification. Did you know Ajahn Panyawado? I saw the DVD about him that Abhaya Giri offers and listened to some of his Dhamma talks and was touched by how gentle he seemed. Is it true that a rainbow appeared during the cremation of his body? I did know him, not very well. You've met him on several occasions.
I spent 2 months with him.
He was a Western disciple of Ajahn Mahabua. He actually ordained in Thailand and went right back to England. Now, the early days of the establishing of, or trying to establish Buddhism in, and a monastic presence in England. That was in the late 50s, early 60s, something like that. And he very dutifully did his 5 years as a junior monk. And I think by the end of that, of all the monks who ordained, they'd all disrobed by then. And then he went to Thailand, and I don't think he ever went back to the West again. It was like 50 years he just lived in Thailand.
Didn't you go once with Ajahn Mahabua in the 70s?
Maybe, Ajahn Mahabua went. Yeah, that's
went
true.
Went once.
True. Went one time for a short visit. And other than that, he spent all of that time at Ajahn Mahabua's monastery in the northeast of Thailand. Didn't really go anywhere else, didn't look for another teacher, didn't look for another place. And he was a very gentle and delightful being. And I don't know,
I was there.
You were there.
I was there. Okay. And it wasn't a rainbow. And I want to say, I've seen probably hundreds of rainbows in my life, so that wouldn't have been that amazing. But this was, it's still a natural phenomenon, but I've only seen one in my life, and it's in the middle of the day, and it's the sun, and it's a ring around the sun. If it was the moon, you call it a corona. Mm-hmm. But I've never seen anything quite as kind of unusual, and it happened just when they were, I mean, it really was amazing timing, just when we were lighting the fire. So we all came out to kind of circle around the body, and this kind of appeared, and everyone, look, look, and everyone looks up, and holy cow. So that was something else.
Can you offer some inspiration to the group as to observing the 8 precepts on Uposatha days? I have been observing every quarter moon, and it would be comforting to know that I'm part of a larger group. Please reflect on the value of restraint outside of the retreat environment. Yeah, certainly this is a classical Buddhist practice on the lunar quarters, taking on the 8 precepts in the sense of simplifying one's life, putting the focus, giving oneself the opportunity to chant, meditate, have Dhamma discussion with others. In the West, it's probably a lot more difficult to coordinate. And certainly in Thailand, life has been revolving around the lunar quarters for millennia, so it's pretty easy. And in places like Wat Pho Phong, Wat Nana Cha, like Ajahn Chah's monastery, every week there's 200-300 people come and observe the precepts and listen to Dhamma, practice meditation. Wat Nana Cha, there's usually 80, 90, 100 people easily. It's quite incredibly inspiring. First time I experienced that, when I was a new monk, I went up to Ubon to pay respects to Ajahn Chah, and the hall was full of monastics and then the lay people, all listening to Dhamma, sitting meditation through the whole night. Then I could hardly sit still, and aching, painful knees, and concrete floor. But tremendous faith and vigor. It's wonderful to see. Also, there is a discourse where the Buddha recollects his, because a lunar observance day is something that is common to all the different religious sects, and they do it in different ways. Then the Buddha reflecting on, there's starting to be a kind of a movement, a gathering around him, and he's sort of reflecting, he's relating his own reflective process, and the arahants, those enlightened beings, they spend their whole life not taking what isn't given, not taking life. Suppose the lay people just spent a day and a night living like the arahants, not taking life. That'd be a wonderful thing. So then it's going through those eight precepts. This is how the arahants live, as enlightened beings live. And that'd be a nice opportunity for the lay people to live like the arahants. It's sort of that simple. Did you say in previous Q&A that only through Buddha Dhamma can one become liberated? I don't think so. I don't think I said that. Anyway, no one in any other wisdom, spiritual tradition? Well, I am profoundly grateful for the Triple Gem. It seems dangerously fundamentalist to assume there is no other path possible. Is it so? I don't think I said that. In Buddhist tradition, you have something that is called a Pajeka Buddha, the one who is enlightened on their own. Even within the Buddhist tradition, you've got beings who are enlightened on their own, outside of the tradition. How does one use the kasina and nimitta in meditation? Well, kasina are like visual objects, and the use of a kasina can be usually with color, could be image of water, earth, light, so that those are particular meditations that are used for, they develop very strong concentration, but they're using an external object, which you then internalize. So it's like you view or gaze on this particular object until you start getting a reflex image arising in the mind. And then with that image in the mind, then you allow that to stabilize and absorb into that color or that water, or the image of water, how it manifests in the mind after. So that the image that comes up as like a reflex image in the mind is what's called a nimitta. So one can then take that nimitta as an object to stabilize and absorb into. That's a very brief overview. How does one overcome the threefold conceit, mana, omana, atimana? And then by seeing anicca and anatta in both self and other. So that's all of that aspect of perspective of the Buddha, that sense of conceit is, like in English, it's the considering oneself better than somebody. But from how the Buddha uses conceit as taking a self-position in comparison to others in terms of either inferior, superior, or equal. And as long as one is trying to establish some sort of position with others, then one is going to create suffering. So it's like seeing the impermanence, the unsatisfactoriness, the suffering that arises, and the recognition of, yeah, that is all insubstantial, it's all constructed. And that by seeing that, then there's that ability to relinquish. In the end, getting tired of that, tired of propping up a self-position. Any tips for stirring up the energy, wirya, that fuels right effort when coffee isn't enough? The main way that energy is generated is through finding something that's interesting, casting the meditation in a way that one is able to take an interest, make it interesting in some way, and that's where the energy will arise. Is the deathless element, the knowing, as Ajahn Chah called it, and Rigpa, as the Tibetans call it, the same thing? And how is that different from the fifth khanda, consciousness? Finally, how can one practice with seeing the grasping of that khanda in meditation? I don't know enough about the Rigpa and what it refers to within the Tibetan tradition, so I can't really comment on that. And the deathless element, or Ajahn Chah referring it to the knowing in a particular way, puru, the difference with fifth khanda consciousness is that the function of consciousness as a khanda is just a knowledge of the senses. Consciousness of the eye, consciousness of the ear, consciousness of the nose. It performs a very ordinary, mundane function. And in terms of the recognition of grasping, probably consciousness is so quick that it's probably more apparent in aspects of the mental formation as opposed to consciousness. But through extrapolation, one's consciousness is functioning with grasping, but it's more through seeing that manifestation, suffering, dis-ease, discontent, that one starts to recognize, okay, there is some form of grasping taking place. I mean, the grasping could also be taking place in terms of an assumption of selfhood within consciousness. I am some kind of global consciousness proliferating around that. So, I mean, that's a means by which we can sometimes be, that one can recognize that there's some form of grasping taking place within that. The quality of breath can change to very light, creating some pleasant changes like pain control. To what extent can breath be manipulated? Doesn't pure awareness act as an agent of change as well? What is the difference? Is this the source of self-healing? And absolutely, the breath becomes more that quality of light, or imbue it with a certain energy, you can be manipulating the breath and using the breath as a vehicle for settling, relaxing, healing, or just settling. It's hard to sometimes know what one can be referring to when saying pure awareness, but certainly as, say, awareness, mindfulness is bright and spacious, it has an effect on the body, on the mind. But there's also particular ways that one can be using in terms of self-healing through the breath or through energy or a particular kind of concentration, or there's many different ways that one can be doing that, or through some perception of light that one brings through. There's a monk that I know, he came to do some healing on Ajahn Chah. I think he was about 102 at the time. Anyway, he was staying at Wat Pa Pong and he slipped and fell in the bathroom and hit his head. It was really, and it was bruised and discolored immediately. I mean, it was a hard fall. And then we, very concerned, wanted to look after him. And he kind of said, no, just leave me alone. And don't bother me. And he went, I think it was in the afternoon, and then the rest of that afternoon, the evening, he didn't come out. And then early morning, we went to take some breakfast to him, and it was all gone. He'd healed himself. And he used to be a proponent of green light. Green light, he felt, was rather special healing energy to it. Most of the time, I feel like a duck in a world full of chickens. Any advice on techniques to prevent the urge to compare myself to others would be greatly appreciated. P.S. After last night's advice to ask our respected teacher all our questions, we're going to need a bigger basket as opposed to a smaller one. Well, there were lots of questions again tonight. So. I think one of the things is, you know, in terms of recognizing, you know, in that sense of comparing oneself to others, really recognize the burden that it is, the kind of ways that the mind just sort of tangles itself up in needless suffering. Of course, that was an image that Ajahn Chah used of how we create suffering. He giving the story of, you know, you walk into the village, and villages in Thailand, they keep various animals around, like ducks and chickens, and you start going into this sort of rant in your mind, you know, why? Yeah, look at these chickens, they can run so good, and there's ducks, I mean, look at, they waddle along, they're pretty pathetic. And then the chickens in the morning, they get up and they, you know, rooster, it crows, and it has some. And then, you know, the ducks, you know, just whack, 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 whack. You know, why aren't the ducks more like chickens? You know, those ducks should be more like chickens. The problem of the world is people trying to make ducks like chickens. You know, so that just be able to look at the world and sort of say, well, ducks are like ducks and chickens are like chickens, and that's okay. You know, we're like this, they're like that, the world is like this, and why make a problem out of it? What's the difference between mental formations and perception? I'm confused. Mental formation, the characteristic of mental formation is intention or volition. Perception is a much more sort of primary, or in the sense of just an immediate perception. There's not a thought process going on. A recognition of something, trying to slot it into memory, certain to have an association, associative thinking, so or an association that one has, that sort of perception is not formulating a whole mental process. Through volition, intention, say, acting on feeling and perception, then there's a formulating of either thinking, thoughts, emotion, mindfulness is a mental formation, wisdom is a mental formation, loving kindness is a mental formation, irritation and is a mental formation, grasping and greed is a mental formation. It's sort of the more formulated movement within the mind. Last one. Can you give us a short bio on each of you, please? That's the last one. Well, we were all born. Some at different times.
Maybe we can do that tomorrow at 1:30.
Somebody's angling. Just give a very brief background for yourself. Yeah?
Myself?
Sure.
Born in Edmonton, Canada. 1968, I went to a couple years at university and felt after that that I needed to find a spiritual teacher. I was interested in Buddhism for many years. Trungpa was a big influence. Alan Watts was a big influence. Bought a ticket to go to Tibet. Actually, this is a nice story, real quickly. I mean, actually, I think almost everybody has heard it, because people who I know have heard this. But so I was in Bangkok, and I was on my way to India, and I thought I was going to spend just a few days in Thailand. And I was wearing white at the time. I was 22. I was in a restaurant, and a couple of Thai men really excited to see me and say, "Oh, are you Buddhist? You're Buddhist, you're Buddhist." I said, "Yeah, I'm a Buddhist. I'm on my way to Tibet." And they took my Lonely Planet's guidebook, and they wrote down Ajahn Chah's monastery, Wat Pa Phong. And said, you've got to go, number one. I wasn't very interested in going. My impression of Theravadan Buddhism wasn't very favorable at the time. But I went and met Ajahn Pasano. He was the abbot of Wat Nanachat. And in time, I met Ajahn Sumedho came through. He was visiting. And that was about a time I realized that I should ordain in this tradition. And I think now often about this just in the restaurant, how if you know Thai people, it's like they'd be so thrilled to know just their noble speech. Like, they praised Ajahn Chah to this stranger, and the result is I've been a monk for almost 20 years. I've been in the ropes for over 20 years, so I would love to communicate my appreciation, but I don't know their address.
I was born in Denver, Colorado in 1986. I started practicing meditation during my first year of university when I was 17. And after my second year of university, I was completely disillusioned with higher education. So I tried a couple of years as a householder and became pretty bad with that as well. So then I tried a couple of years at a Zen monastery, Asahara, and also a few months at Green Gulch. And that was pretty good. But I started reading Ajahn Chah and Buddhist Monastic Code, fell in love with the Theravada, its directness of teachings. I really adore the Vinaya. Came up to this place to check it out about 2.5 years ago.
Born in North Carolina in 1955. Worked as a registered nurse for almost 20 years. At the age of 40, decided to go ahead and take ordination. Been practicing as a layperson in this tradition probably for about 8 or 10 years. Took ordination at Abhayagiri when we opened in 1996. Took the Anagarika ordination then, and Bhikkhu ordination in 98. So I've been fully ordained for 14 years.
Georgia.
I was born in Seattle in 1987. Just about out of college, about a year ago, up in Oregon. Yeah, I came across Buddhism about 2 years into college. Kind of did a 180, and you kind of learn my approach to life. So just a huge change. So the next few years kind of began to get deeper into the study of Buddhism. Yeah, eventually just kind of felt led to moving to Bhayagiri just this past March.
Debbie?
I was born. I was in the late 80s, kind of that new sense about what my next step was going to be, because career didn't ever seem to be happening. A friend of mine was leading a photography workshop in Nepal, so I lived out of my car for 6 months and saved money to go on that, and then decided since I was there I would travel until I ran out of money, because I probably would never get another opportunity like that. Got sick in the fall, So instead of going on to India, I decided some friends were in Thailand, which Thailand very limit my travels. Oh, I also went into Tibet, and I was extremely inspired by the devotional side of the Tibetans. I was on my way back through Thailand, on my way in, when England was going to be my buffer, kind of a re-entry back into the West. I had a friend in London, decided to take a retreat just to learn something about Buddhism, so I didn't know anything about it. I just happened to catch a 10-day retreat down. It was through Suan Mok. The first talk was a talk of Ajahn Buddhadasa's on tape, and that was it. Kind of like all of a sudden the puzzle pieces fit together, but I couldn't quite see the puzzle clearly. So a monk there gave me information about Amravati and Chittorasya, and I spent the next year in England, about 10 months of that time between Chittorasya and Amravati. Came back to California, got a phone call from Daniel Barnes asking if I wanted to be part of a group to start a monastery in California. And here I am.
Okay, thank you.
Hey. She's the mother of our monastery. It should be very clear. She was an important part in getting the whole thing going.
Yeah.